You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm the Chief Executive of the RSA, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to this evening's event, which we're delighted to be running in partnership with Pearson. I have with me on the stage Michael Barber, who needs very little introduction. Michael is Pearson's Chief Education Advisor, leads a worldwide program of research that seeks, amongst other things, to ensure the efficacy of Pearson's products and services in improving people's lives through learning. Prior to Pearson, Michael was head of McKinsey's Global Education Practice, and prior to that, of course, he served the UK government as head of the Prime Minister's Delivery Unit and as Chief Advisor to the Secretary of State for Education on school standards. So the background to this conversation this evening is a series of seminars that we've held with Pearson about this concept of efficacy, and I'm going to come to that in a few minutes. But you came to Pearson with a background, and I want to just explore that for a while before we talk about the Pearson work. So I know this is a very big question, Michael, but where do you think we are now in terms of the kind of global debate about getting the best citizen outcomes from public services? How is that debate poised, do you think? It's because you work, and you know, you're going to Pakistan tomorrow. You work globally.
Yeah. I was expecting an easier question first, but that's.
Do you think Liverpool will qualify for the Champions League
this year? No.
Okay, fine. No.
But you never know. Live in hope. A couple of things have become really clear. One is, I think more than ever before, the effectiveness of government is kind of right in front of us, because we see parts of the world where it's completely imploded, and you see what happens when there isn't an effective government. And even when you have got a functioning government, because of the pressures of the financial crisis, because of the demands people are making on the government, on governments, again, around the world, what you see is people really demanding that government delivers for them. But at the same time not being willing to pay ever-increasing amounts of money for that delivery, which is a dilemma, sometimes a contradiction, but a driver definitely of innovation. So that's one big change, and I think that's somehow the last 10 years that the pressure for government to deliver right around the world has increased, and the visibility of places without government has increased. So that's one thing. The second thing is, compared to when you and I were in Downing Street, which is only 10 years ago, the amount of data around and available to analyse, make sense of things, has just exploded. So that's the second big trend. The third, though, is that the global economy has shown us that however effective government is, there's a lot of things that aren't in the control of government, and you need governments to respond as they tried to do to those big crises. But there's a whole sort of surge of human activity that is way beyond control of government, that was always there, but is greater than before. So if you put those three things together, I think the global debate is challenging, because there's an undertow, and you see it in European elections, you see it in American elections, and you certainly see it in places like Pakistan, that people have kind of given up on government. They're pretty sceptical about its effectiveness. They don't really think it's going to deliver. I see it. The thing that drives me most crazy in Pakistan is people say poor parents don't want their children to be educated, whereas actually they clearly do, and they're choosing low-cost private schools in droves because the government system has been letting them down for so long, and that's true across large swathes of India and Africa. So The challenges have got greater, and the level of cynicism or lack of faith in government's ability to deliver is quite high. So actually I think it's quite a challenging time, and the worry comes where cynicism about a particular government becomes cynicism about government and democracy in general, and then you've got real fundamental challenges on your hand about whether we've got the models right.
So does the kind of incremental improvement, albeit often very impressive incremental improvement, that the kind of delivery concept has given us, and the delivery concept that you developed has been copied in governments and provinces and cities around the world, is the kind of incremental improvement that that offers at its best not simply not sufficient to deal with this kind of growing gulf between citizen expectations and attitudes and government resources and capacities?
Well, I think, first of all, incremental progress is good if you can get it, because it's better than not having progress and not to be knocked. And, you know, I had the good fortune of meeting the head of British UK Cycling, former head of UK Cycling, head of Team Sky Cycling, whose whole thing is about the aggregation of marginal gains. And, you know, he's won, or his team has won, two Tour de France, and they won lots of gold medals in lots of Olympics by aggregating marginal gains. So there's a lot to be said for aggregating marginal gains. But the second thing, which I don't quite accept the premise of your question, because where you set really ambitious goals and then set out to achieve them, if you set them ambitiously enough, you have to innovate to deliver the goal. In other words, you don't know enough at the beginning to deliver the goal. So if you set a really ambitious goal, it actually helps drive innovation. So I just want to tease out this incremental versus innovation and step change, or whatever phrase you want to use, because I think a delivery approach can do that at its best.
So delivery can... Because sometimes often it seems to me there's almost a disconnect between what is being achieved in the policy domain, the delivery domain, and the kind of wider, rather toxic discourse that is taking place around between government and citizens. And I think we used to talk in Number 10 about the kind of delivery, was it delivery tragedy or whatever, yeah, or paradox, which was that people would recognise delivery in local institutions, local services, but they wouldn't connect it to their attitudes to government, which remained very negative.
Yeah, and I mean, you've been writing in the RSA Journal about the whole sort of policy presumption and the sense that the governments always think that everything is amenable to policy, and that in itself is as I understood your argument, is a fundamental flaw, and they have to think about other ways of changing society that don't depend on legislation, regulation, and spending money. Mm. Basically, that was your argument. And I read that because I was thinking, just been publishing a book about how to get governments to do things, and at one level there's a contradiction, but I also think that the only way you're going to get big improvements in outcomes in the broad public services that people in this room and across the country and across the world care about is if you unlock some citizen motivation. So you can't just do it with those three levers of legislation, regulation, and spending money. They're all important, and it's important to do them well rather than badly. But on their own, they're not going to bring about the changes. So if you think of the changes we need in healthcare, you know, we did reduce health waiting times. But what will really improve people's health is if they stop smoking, do more exercise, eat the right things, if parents get their children to do the homework, be motivated about school, do lots of things out of school that inspires them. So that citizen motivation is a key way of improving outcomes that, if you get it right, incidentally doesn't necessarily cost money and won't be delivered through legislation or regulation, but you do need to think about how to do that.
And this, well, I want to come back to that point when we talk about the Pearson stuff, because I think that's one of the interesting things that's come out of our work. So just one last question around kind of your learning leading up to the work in Pearson. Someone once said this to me, I thought it was a rather cheeky question, Michael, but so I quoted you to somebody once, and they said, ah, yes, but is that pre-Barber Barber, Barber Barber, or post-Barber Barber? So do you recognise what's implicit in that, which is that you yourself have been on some kind of journey in terms of your thinking from a kind of initial kind of starting point, which might have been kind of more kind of radical, kind of more sociological in terms of understanding challenges, to a focus, a more technocratic, more top-down kind of approach to how it is you drive change, to now possibly moving to a greater recognition of things like, you know, whole systems and complexity. That's the kind of what's implicit in that suggestion. Is that a crude caricature of your journey?
It's fairly crude, but it's not inaccurate. So, and I don't want to deny it. I mean, I'd be really disappointed to sit on any platform anywhere in an organisation as august as the RSA and say I haven't learned anything over the last 15 years. You know, that would be really disappointing. And the Pearson logo is always learning. And if I wasn't making progress, I'd be really disappointed. And the world is changing. And I think when I was in my two positions in government, one in the Department for Education and then one in Number 10, I thought, unless somebody really drives the nuts and bolts of this, none of it's going to get done. So I almost chose to be a caricature of myself because I knew everybody else would be chipping away at that. And I thought, somebody's got to be that person because that's how we're going to get stuff done. And I broadly believe that. And in the work in Punjab, where I'm about to make my 44th visit, and we've got 2 million extra children into school, and the teachers now 93% of the time turn up as opposed to under 80% of the time a few years ago, and the water runs and the electricity runs. That wouldn't happen without a real focus on getting the system, the nuts and bolts of the system, to work. So I don't knock any of that, but I also totally understand that the outcomes people want, that levels of satisfaction, that the quality, for example, of the interaction between a patient and and staff in the NHS is not amenable solely to that. That's not the sole solution. So I totally accept that. So I probably plead guilty to being a caricature of myself and having chosen to do that in number 10 because I thought somebody needed to do that. Mm. I mean, you could go around having the big conversation. Mm-hmm. I was trying to get some results.
Less of the big conversation. Well, actually, funny you should say the big conversation. Before we move on to talk more about Pearson, are there any questions that people want to ask at this stage of the evening just around the kind of broader notions of delivery and government targets and that kind of way of thinking about change? So I rather sprung it on you. But here's somebody I could rely on to have a question on their tip of their tongue at all times.
I had a very brief position in the last year of the 74-79 government as a special advisor in health. And the amazing thing there was the difference between the health side and the social security side. Because the social security side had all the math, knew what the benefits were, knew if they took a decision what the redistributive effect would have been, and knew it would be implemented. Whereas the health side, they didn't quite know how big these problems were, didn't quite know how to measure them, didn't even know if they created a new policy, it would be implemented in the 14 regions. So all the structures of what you're trying to do seems to me are terribly important. And how did you find going from education to Downing Street? Whereas in education, at least you've got a system where everybody has to go to school. We do monitor it pretty closely, so you know what's happening at one point and hopefully know what's happening at a further one. When you get to Downing Street and you have to deal with social health and all those other areas, with not nearly as many levers to pull.
Well, Malcolm says he's ex-Guardian, but that doesn't just mean his reading habits have changed. He used to work for the Guardian. People are sitting here thinking, oh, do I have to say I used to read the Daily Mail? But no, it's fine.
Well, the question you asked was the challenge we face. How do you, from Downing Street, get anything done at all? Because when you're on the outside of Downing Street looking at it, you think, God, they're really powerful in there. And when you're on the inside looking at it, you're a really small organisation looking at these massive bureaucracies.
Didn't you have a target for reducing poppy cultivation in Afghanistan?
There was a sort of random... that was the far-flung corner of delivery. That was a corner of a foreign field that we didn't quite get our act together. But in the end, it's all about, you need some systems. So you need regular data, you need routines to check progress, but in the end you have to get the relationships between yourself in number 10 and the relevant department right. And we worked really hard in the delivery unit, as it's called, on getting the relationships right, because if you go around like yelling at people like in the West Wing, they stop telling you things. You have to build the relationship, and we thought very, very carefully about how to get the relationship, and the deal with the relevant minister in, say, health was, we're going to help you get the bureaucracy to do what you want it to do, because you and the cabinet are signed up to these goals. And then the deal for the bureaucracy was, we're going to stop, keep Prime Minister Blair focused on some goals all the way through a term. He's not going to change his mind all the time. It's going to be steady. And by the way, when we help you solve the problems, we're going to give you the credit. We don't want any credit. And we built these relationships, and they were the fundamental part of making this thing succeed. So although Matthew's right, the targets and the sort of routine stock takes and the monthly notes to Tony Blair and all of those things were, and the data and the analysis were important, the relationships were, in my view, as fundamental.
Ron Glass of Vietnam University and other places. I heard you on the Today programme recently, yeah. And you were making the point that any change involves challenging people, challenging doctors, teachers, and all the rest of it. And my first thought was, yes, provided you've got a better answer than anybody else has. And that's often people's view, doctors and teachers and others, as you'll know better than many, view of government, that, OK, that's fair enough, but what they're doing is not necessarily they've got it wrong. How does one square that particular circle?
Yeah, well generally speaking, I should say, I'll preface this by, on Saturday I spoke at the Association of School and College Leaders annual event, which finished on Saturday afternoon. And they've set out a blueprint for the future of the education system, and their president and their general secretary made speeches about that. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I think it's the best agenda I've seen set for the future of a system by a professional organisation for a very long time, and I really encourage them to get on and lead the system. Because one of the insights, maybe an insight since... number 10 in the whatever you call it, the post-Barber-Barber, is that you can mandate adequacy. So if you're in government, you can get a system to go from awful to adequate, but you can't make it great. You can't mandate greatness. The English language won't let you say, I mandate greatness. You have to unleash greatness. And I felt among this group of 1,500 head teachers on Saturday that they were on the brink of unleashing greatness, and they should just get on and do that. So I say that, but by way of starting, but in government, you have a responsibility to try and improve systems incrementally, if at least, and hopefully even more than that. And if you can assemble a strategy and structure a system to deliver that and push the change faster, you are going to run into conflict sometimes, because people who work in systems generally are going to, or often, are going to resist it, or they want you to go slower, they don't want you to do it at all because change is hard. And I think one of the roles of number 10, by the way, in government, is to be vigorous, urgent, and demanding about change, because the departments are closer to the pressure groups that are trying to slow things down, whereas in number 10, you're one step removed from them, and so you can keep the clarity and vigour. But I agree there's a risk there. Yes, of course. Yeah, no, well, if you impose bad change, you're going to pay for it in having an argument and make things worse, which would be really bad. So you need to, and that's where we need evidence-based policy. It's why we need data. And the data was fundamental to delivery, because you can adjust as you go along in the light of what's working. And if you're getting data from a whole system, 300 hospitals, you'll find some that are working and some that aren't. So you can adjust. Rather than big blanket regulation, you can target the effort to make change where it's needed. You can learn from the best performers. And I think that was one of the key things about the delivery unit, actually, was we learned as we went along. And that's what enabled change to be delivered that was actually sometimes beyond incremental.
This was one of the points I was making that RSA Journal piece, Michael, which is that the problem with policy is that it doesn't allow that kind of continuous learning. You know, the legislation is very slow, it's very clunky, you introduce a new system, you know, Andrew Lansley reorganises the health service. The scope which exists for learning to take place and adjustments to take place is extremely limited. And so therefore you end up, and we both saw this in number 10 in relation to things like ID cards, I suspect, which is you end up investing in something, and even when the evidence is starting to come back that leads you to believe it wasn't the right policy, you've really got into the business of continuously justifying it. You know, and that's why civil servants end up telling ministers what ministers want to hear, because in a way there's no point telling the minister something bad because the minister can't change it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if your point is, as I understand it to be, that sometimes you get into that sort of policy doom loop, I totally agree. And I think one of the critical things to put in place is to make the system a learning system for which you need. Good data flowing. If you want evidence-based policy, you have to have evidence, and that data needs to be as close to real-time as possible. And then you need the right people in the room, and you need to address what that book, The Blunders of Our Governments, call the deficit of deliberation. You need a proper deliberative process.
And are Whitehall and Westminster currently geared up to be that kind of fast-loop learning environment? It seems to me that they're quite obviously not.
Well,
from the Public Accounts Committee to, you know, the kind of size of the cabinet, this is not a system that is geared towards fast learning.
I agree, but in general, you can put in place some of those elements and make them work. Because after all, there's a big machine there, and it's doing stuff all the time. So the more you can get it to be something like a learning system, the better it will be. And I think at its best, the delivery stuff did bring that about. We did learn as we went along. We did stop doing things that weren't working. We did do more of the stuff that was working. We did adjust as we went along. And I've now seen that in lots of countries. If you look at, say, Martin O'Malley in Maryland, 2 terms as governor, really impressive. Look at Mitch Daniels. I'm just making sure I've got a Democrat and a Republican. Mitch Daniels in Indiana, similar, spectacular performance using that kind of technique.
Yeah. I think it's easier, actually, for city leaders
very
often than it is for national leaders. Yes. They're closer to the action. Yes, yep. Sorry.
Stuart Bear, I've just finished leading a commercial organisation delivering public services, and it seems to me that having been involved in some of the debates that have led up to this evening, competence is really important, because if you've not got competence, then you haven't got the means to involve people in efficacy or being efficient.
Yeah.
Engagement, because if they don't get the messages, as the previous speaker was saying, then you might as well not start the conversation. And then there's authority, because that's very difficult in public services. And then the corollary of that is blame. And we see a lot of that, whether it's real or not, for political reasons. But the effect that has on people is to become risk averse, and learning only happens if you take some risks and the organisation's able to accept some risk and not to point the finger.
Yes, I mean, these are very good points. So, part the competence point is part of the answer to Ron's previous question, because if you're asking a big professional group to do something new and different, their competence to it and enabling, helping helping them build their competence to it is very, very important. And governments generally around the world often miss the importance of really good investment in people's capacity and skills and how to do that well. I think that is absolutely fundamental. And it leads to your second point, because often the competence comes before the engagement. You're unlikely to be engaged in something that you're not sure about and you don't know how to do. But once you've learned how to do it, you can find it very engaging if it's working, and if you see the children learning better or the patients happier or whatever, whoever it is that you're serving. So I think competence and engagement, or capability and engagement, often go very well together. On blame, I talk about this in the book that Ron heard me talk about on the Today programme. In Russia, when I used to go to Russia quite a lot, when it was a little bit more pleasant than it is currently, and they said, I started learning very small bits of Russian, and my Russian friend said, you only really need 2 phrases to get around in government circles in Russia. One is kto vinovat, which is who's to blame, and the other is shto delyat, which is what's to be done. When you've got a problem in government, it's really important to ask the shto delyat question before you ask the kto vinovat question. So what are we going to do? Solve the problem and deal with the blame later if you need to, but maybe you don't. I totally agree with you. In answer to the question about how we worked in number 10, we didn't deal with blame in the delivery unit. We just solved problems. We accepted our share of responsibility. We absolutely went out of our way not to yell at people, not to accuse them of failing. And the same is true of the relationships with the professional groups. You really need to get people to focus on the problem, use the data, and remind them constantly that often government is feeling the heat from the citizen or the consumer or the user of the service in an indirect way that is then being reflected back through the government, but actually government is representing the citizen.
I promise you we are going to move on to the Pearson stuff, but I just have to ask this question because I think it may be in the room, which is, when listening to all of this, Mike, listening to the way you talk about it, it's hard to disagree with any of it. But yet we know that what happened in the Labour years, at the same time as you run the delivery unit, driving these targets, improving performance, and Labour was also really stuffing money into the pockets of public service workers and managers and systems, at the end of that, morale in the public services was lower, if anything, than at the beginning. So what was it that went wrong that this process didn't seem to engage so much of the front line? Or is that a myth?
I don't think it's true that morale was lower at the end.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, most In many professional groups, they'll tell you at any given moment that morale is lower than ever.
That's
so
true.
There's always that. That is just a kind of professional risk. But also, I used to occasionally, fortunately, go to the GP when I was working in number 10, and I always got a kind of earful of critique while they fixed whatever it was that needed fixing. Now when I go, they say that was a golden age.
Right.
They talk about the Milburn years as a golden age. They do. So the golden age is always a little bit in the past. I don't think morale was that. Steve Mumby was sorting out the National College for School Leadership. I think head teachers' morale wasn't the lowest it had ever been at the end of those years. I think it was really on the rise. So I just don't accept the premise.
No, fair enough.
And in fact, the system was performing better.
So we've undertaken these seminars around notion of efficacy and peers, and I want to open up some of these questions because I think they touch on some of the ideas that we've already been listening to from the floor. But just before we start, just give us a kind of 5-minute account of what the efficacy framework is at Pearson, what you're setting out to do.
So Pearson is a global education company, a FTSE 100 company, and its mission is to improve people's lives through learning. That's the slogan. It sells to a range of buyers, sometimes direct to consumers, sometimes to governments and or universities or whatever, a range of products to help with learning. So assessments, curriculum materials, all the kind of inside services of a university. There's a whole wide range of products. And obviously for a long time and still a significant part of the company, textbooks for higher education. So that's what Pearson does. And over the last 15 years, it's focused more and more and more on being an education and a learning company. I started there in 2011. Some of my team are in the room. And we had heard people in Pearson, I had heard before I went, and it was one of the things that excited me about going there, talk about efficacy, by which they mean measuring the impact of everything, all the products that Pearson produces on learner outcomes. Obviously, in a large company, somebody's measuring the impact on financial outcomes. Mm. Could you measure the impact on learner outcomes? And people were talking about it, but actually doing it wasn't happening. In the team, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've tried to put in place, I think with some success, so there's a long way to go, a system that will enable us to do that. So the first thing we did, and we didn't do it in a top-down way, you might be surprised to hear, we did it in a kind of lateral way. We built a network of people who were enthusiasts for this and designed a process for reviewing a product. Did it have efficacy? And then we trained a couple of hundred people around the company to do that, and they started reviewing products. And what we found, I'll talk about the efficacy framework in a moment, what we found is when we did these reviews, which could be done really quite quickly in a few days, that you really motivated and engaged the team because they were working away on some product that they were committed to, but only, people in management only ever asked them about were they hitting their financial targets. And now somebody was saying to them, are your learners really benefiting? And it reminded them and excited them that that's why they'd come to Pearson in the first place. So this became a bit of a kind of lateral movement across the company. And then our current chief executive, John Fallon, took over in January 2013, and he had become an enthusiast, and he put it at the heart of the new strategy. The efficacy framework basically asks a set of questions. It's online. It's all the way we do this is public. And the four questions are, what are you trying to do? So what learner outcomes is this product designed to change? Second question is, effectively, why should we believe you that you can do that? So where's the evidence? And third question is, have you got the capacity to make... have you got a plan to make this happen? And what's the plan? Is it a good plan? And the fourth one is, have you got all the relationships in the system you're dealing with to ensure that that plan can work? Because if to change learner outcomes with curriculum materials, you've probably got to affect how the teacher teaches and how the student learns. And so it's a complex challenge. It's not all within the control of Pearson, so the fourth bit's really important. And we ask those questions, and there's more detail than I've given, but it engages people in debate. Well, what learner outcomes would we like to achieve, and have we got the evidence, and when did we last look at the research that should inform this product? And now that's being built into the way we design and develop products. So it's not just pre-existing products, but it will be built into the design of all new products. So it's it's getting people to think about the learning outcomes they want to change. It's getting people to draw on the evidence in the design of products and then to plan that and to build the relationships on which success will depend.
So one of the reasons I was impressed by this idea and initially wrote about it in a complimentary way was that I think that corporate social responsibility is generally speaking pretty marginal unless it goes to the heart of the kind of business model of an organisation. Yeah. And what impressed me about what Pearson were trying to do was, in essence, what you were saying was, we want to move to a system where if we don't think a product is efficacious, we ain't going to flog it, even if we could flog it and even if it could make us money.
Yes.
Now, for that to be real, it must be leading to tensions in the organisation. There must be people saying, well, hang on, I'm getting a massive commission on this product and the people I'm selling it to want to carry on using it and the teachers are happy with it because they're used to it and you're coming along and telling me that it's not... I mean, is that happening?
That gets debated and there have been some tensions over the last 2 or 3 years. I think that's pretty much behind us.
So it wasn't an issue at all?
No. It was an issue and it was debated. I think the key thing is that we've now already made some decisions either not to proceed with an acquisition because we couldn't see the path to efficacy, even though it would have been financially profitable, and some divestment decisions where we said, actually, we don't think we'll ever get those on the path to get efficacy. And people are seeing that it is becoming real. But yes, it needs a total change in the mindset. And people were... It's like any big change. For a while, people weren't sure it was really going to happen. And so they talk about it and they debate it and they kind of argue, make these kinds of points. And there may have been some overt resistance, so I didn't see any of that. But once it became central to the strategy and then people saw that it began to work, it made a difference. And it's consistent with two very big trends that are happening in the world. One I mentioned earlier, which is the availability of data. The second is this whole shift from print to digital. If you produce a textbook, let's say you produce a textbook in America, what you want to do is get a state to buy that as the state textbook in math, for example. And then after you've done that contract, you don't have to go back for another 5 years. So it's a transactional event which revolves around building relationships with people in government circles until you win the contract, or you hope you win the contract. But if you're selling digital materials, they are that you can update them all the time in the light of the teachers or the students who are using them, and so they're constantly changing. In fact, you can then use them to build a network. So this teacher has solved a problem with Latino girls who are struggling with this particular bit of English grammar, and that teacher, 1,000 miles away, networked in, can learn from that teacher. So the relationship ceases to be transactional and becomes continuous, and that's what will change the company.
I remember hearing Salman Khan from Khan Academy talk about this kind of algorithmic learning, as it were, that you get feedback, you can A-B test things all the time and see what works. Is that really transforming the nature of the business then, that capacity for real-time learning? Because presumably, I mean, what Simon was saying was that, he can actually say, well, we'll try out, I mean, crudely, we can try doing this visualization in red and doing it in blue with 1,000 students on one day. We can look at their results and we can tell you whether red or blue is a better way of visualizing this and immediately operate on it, work on it.
You can. I mean, I'm not certainly claiming that the company's gone through that whole transition, but you can see that's where it's going and it's best it is doing that. And you can look at eye tracking on a computer screen, for example, and see what turns out to be most motivational and who gets the right answer most, depending on how you set the page out on the, all of that. So there's lots of research at a level of detail that is really important to efficacy and to enjoyment and to engagement that the colleague was asking about over there. So I think this is the way things are beginning to go. And efficacy, I think this is... a happy coincidence rather than a designing thing, really works with that trend because you can you build a relationship and you adjust the efficacy over time as you learn.
So we were talking, people here and your colleagues at Pearson this afternoon, about what's come out of these seminars, and we kind of moved towards one particular way of thinking about it, hot off the press, but which I wanted to kind of share with you, which was a kind of distinction between what we were calling efficacy one and efficacy two, in the sense efficacy one is around specific interventions with a clear outcome, where there's a consensus about the target that people want to reach, where it is possible to evaluate it in fairly kind of straightforward terms. Efficacy two is about the world of kind of complex problems, difficult problems, system-wide problems, problems where there are contesting notions of what a good outcome might be, but also where what you're trying to do is build along the long-term capacity of people, organisations and systems to respond to changing circumstances, which is very different from delivering a specific outcome over a time period. Do you recognise that a distinction between these two notions of efficacy?
I think it is useful, actually, and I think it is, as you imply, by numbering them, a progression. And at the, in effect, mostly what we've been doing in the last two or three years is, to use a crude term, retrofitting efficacy onto existing products. But when you think about the transition that I've just been talking about, with where everything we do will be a relationship rather than a transaction, and a lot of it will be technology, but not all of it. Our ability to learn from our customers, who are sometimes the same as the learners, and from our learners, will be absolutely vital to the success of the company, and our ability to build those relationships and I was going to say deliver the outcomes, but with the customer and or the learner, ensure the outcome occurs and then understand why. I think it will get more complicated. And I mean, just to throw in a complexity, the learning outcomes that people want are increasingly complex as well. I mean, people do want literacy and numeracy, but they also want character, a whole lot of other outcomes from school. We don't know how to do that. There's a whole lot of stuff we don't know how to do. I mean, not just we in this room, but anybody. Nobody knows quite how to do that.
And some of it's just not amenable to measurement in a kind of... Or is it? I mean, or you would end up with a proxy measurement which distracts you from what you're fundamentally getting to.
Yeah. Well, it's... Yes, so some of it's not amenable to measurement, but some of it is stuff you can see, you know it when you see it, which may not be measurable in a test, but maybe something that you would recognise when you saw it. And then, so that does make it more complicated, but that you'd still be looking for the outcome.
I think one of the things that came out of the seminars that we had was the notion that efficacy one, that kind of delivery model based upon a kind of, you know, what works kind of model, which assumes there is a best way of doing things, that lands in organisations in different ways. So, and you must find this as you go around advising governments, that if you're advising somebody who believes in a kind of hierarchical way of doing things, who has a slightly exaggerated idea of the capacity to pull levers from the centre, if you give them this toolkit, it's going to reinforce possibly a set of prejudices, which are actually not very good for the system as a whole, because they are not ones that empower the system. You give that toolkit to somebody else who understands the limits of top-down power, and they will use it intelligently. So do you recognise that too? And as you go around talking to people about the methodologies you use, do you make an assessment yourself of the system that you're going into and how it is they might use these tools?
Yes, so
it's a very long question. I promise you, it's the longest question I'll ask.
It was long, but it was actually very profound and important. So, and I think it is important. So one is certainly if you're talking about governments. So some there's an ethical question, for, you know, before all of that. So there's some governments that you might not want to enable to do anything better. You know, there's that. The second thing, so my generally the ethical question I ask myself is, do I think that by working with whoever it is, they'll be moving in the direction of something that will make the lives of citizens better, freer, enabling? I'm actually quite. I mean, I noticed in your policy presumption article in the RSA, you were quoting some Hayek and Oakeshott and thinkers generally associated with the right, but making very important points. And I thought they were good. And then there's William Easterly at New York University, who basically says if you want development in the world, you need to create property rights, political rights, and keep government small, and then let governments let markets take care of it all. Now that is that's a powerful argument. And what I've written in my new book, I've written basically, this is how to make government effective, but it doesn't matter whether you want small government or big government. You want the governments there to be effective in the sense that I've defined it. So you get into that. But yes, it is like any set of tools. If you put them in the wrong hands and they're used crudely, they can do damage rather than just good. And that is a question you have to keep asking yourself.
Two more questions from me before we open it up to the rest of the room for the remaining time that we've got. One is, tell us about the differences between working within a corporate environment in Pearson on the kind of notion of efficacy and trying to drive a culture change in a global corporate environment and working in a governmental environment. What are the things that are similar and what are things that are different about that?
Well, I was surprised how many similarities there are. Big companies are big bureaucracies. Big government departments are big bureaucracies. So that's one thing. I think
are shareholders more impatient than voters?
I would say no. I think you kind of know what the shareholders think more clearly because you meet the board, and the board at least in theory represent the shareholders. But I think you've got it's easier to make decisions. You've got less media intrusion. You've got some at any given moment, but it's not the same pressure that you feel at the heart of government. And when, as now in Pearson, you've got an executive team that's united around the strategy and organisation, actually it's quite a pleasure to work with that, and it feels more. In government, even in the most united government, there's always a back and forth and, you know, political tensions. The feels less of that. I'm sure there are companies that can be like that, but at the moment, Pearson doesn't feel like that. And so there's a lot of backing. But the sense of trying to get a big change fast in a big organisation, that feels very similar.
And where does it go next, do you think? So it's interesting because I was talking to you about a year ago and your team about a year ago, and it felt at that moment that this was slightly... It wasn't clear it was going to succeed in the end. It wasn't clear you were going to drive that culture change through. I think Pearson's own global kind of profitability might have been slightly weaker for a while. There's a sense of, is this... It feels now you're talking about with more security that you really think it's going to go drive through. And where do you think it goes next?
Yes, I think there's leadership commitment from the whole executive, so that's important. I think the Pearson's financial performance has picked up. And by the way...
You have to often go through a valley, don't you,
before you get
improvement?
Yeah. The famous implementation dip. And that, by the way, is a crucial thing when, you know, you go to Ron's question and these others, that knowing when something's going wrong in government and knowing when you're just going through the implementation dip that you're always going to go through, and distinguishing which is a very, very important thing, because otherwise you're endlessly retreating when actually you should be going forward. The financial performance has picked up, and our efficacy strategy can only work if Pearson is a successful company, profitable, growing, and all of that. And we're very, very conscious of that. So in time, we've got early evidence, but in time, we'll need to show that by focusing on efficacy, we're also ensuring the growth and success of the company. So that's one thing that remains to be done, at least at sort of company-wide level.
What would you do if it didn't?
Well,
what would you do if you say, well, actually, the problem with efficacy is it's hard to make money out of it?
We'd have made a big bad bet on efficacy, and I would probably be looking for another job. I think it will work, but it certainly won't work unless Pearson grows and is a successful company. So I think that's one thing. I think your efficacy too, and that debate is another place that this will go. But I think the prize that we all think we're hoping to see is not just that Pearson succeeds with this, which obviously we would like, but that's not that important to people in the audience, but the idea that the education debate gets shifted onto what are the outcomes we want and how do we know whether we're achieving them and couldn't we get more progress, that's a big idea. And we want to play... We're not... arrogant, but we'd like to play our part in seeing global education systems change, because if you look around the world, there are 70-something million children not in school at all. There are 250 million children who are in school but not learning. And then there's a whole lot more children and young people in educational institutions who aren't learning enough to prepare them to be successful in the modern world. And so we want to play our part in that.
Great. Okay, let's open it up to some questions about this notion of efficacy or Pearson's work or this kind of notion of efficacy in education more broadly.
Thank you. Philippa Cordon.
Oh, it's Philippa. Sorry, Hal. Hello, Philippa.
Hi. Centre for the Use of Research and Evidence in Education. One of the things that I'm really interested in, and it's back to the government thing as well as the efficacy thing, is what happens when the kind of change you want to drive requires reconfiguring organisations. So I'm involved at the moment in some research around exceptional leadership of education and training in local areas as part of the localism agenda. And what we're seeing is lots of collaboration, but really it's partisan mutual adjustment, it's deals, it's bilateral. And everybody knows we could go miles if everyone gave an inch of institutional boundaries. And it's not quite happening. And I think one of the reasons it's not quite happening is that governance isn't part of the piece, governors aren't part of the piece. It's all being conceived as delivery. It's certainly being conceived as efficacy, but it's seen as purely executive. And I don't think you can get there with the organisations giving up the inch if you don't bring governance in as part of the piece. And for me, you know, I'm really interested in the leadership Pearson's showing. And you must, in some of the settings where you're working, the universities in South Africa or whatever, be having to deal with this governance part of the piece. But it does seem to me a really... If we're going to just get radical change, we've got to be able to change the boundaries of the organisation. And that's got to go beyond the executive.
And that's a squarely efficacy too issue.
Yeah. Well, I'm always happy to see you, Philip. And I always know the question's going to be really difficult. So I think you're right. So governance in the sort of organisations is really fundamental, and that's one of the things I've learned very, very deeply since leaving government. I kind of knew it then, but I've seen it at all kinds of levels in all kinds of companies. So one of the things we have at Pearson is the Affordable Learning Fund, where we're investing in low-cost private education in the developing world. And if you get the governance right of those companies, they do well. If you get the governance wrong, that's where it's difficult. I think that's the answer to your question. I really don't know, except to say, if you can get a group of people excited, more excited about the mission and the thing they're trying to change, and the meeting the customer or citizen need and aspiration, then you're more likely to be able to change organisational boundaries, because the organisational boundaries seem less important if it's all about delivering the mission. And an evidence base will help you with that. But the relationships that I was mentioning before are also fundamental. And people like you to kind of facilitate the right relationships to put those things on the agenda, I think, is important. And the last thing I'll say is, it's always a good idea to have somebody in one of those conversations that can ask the difficult questions, which I imagine you're very good at. And I think just putting the difficult questions on the table or on the agenda is a really important part of getting that institutional change.
Given, Michael, how important school-to-school collaboration is, and the RSA is on work on this and argued very strongly for it, do you think that it was a mistake to allow standalone academies? I mean, when we were involved, we were creating initially a small number of academies or academy chains. But I worry about schools that are basically standalone and have very, very few incentives. And I get shocked and actually quite angry when sometimes I meet school leaders who, for whom the sense that they have no responsibility beyond the walls of their own school is really overpowering. And my sense, where is a broader sense of public service ethos that might lead them to want to collaborate and cooperate, for example? So do you think that was wrong?
I think at the beginning, that you to get the academy movement off the ground, probably you had to go one academy at a time, as you know, all of them personally built by Andrew Adonis, as it were. I think that was important, because you had to get them off the ground. I mentioned the head teachers conference at the weekend. I thought the sense of professional collaboration and a real movement there was very powerful with that group of people. So I was quite inspired by that. If I were involved in the policy now, I'd be saying, well, if I've got a school that is delivering outstanding results for its students, I'm not going to force it to do anything. But if its performance isn't that great, I'm going to say, why would we let you carry on being your own school, not collaborating, and you're not really delivering? That I would ask questions, and that's where I think you would use some kind of lever to put pressure on that school to join a network.
Good. For now.
I'm Steve Munley, Chief Executive of CFPT Education Trust. Now, We're trying to do a similar approach to, at CFPT on efficacy, and Pearson's and CFPT have been having dialogue about this. One of the things that I wrestle with is, how do you choose the right outcomes? And even if you try really hard, are you taking into account the consequences, unexpected consequences, of choosing those outcomes and not other outcomes? And, of course, this is especially true when you're trying to do something on a national scale through a target-setting approach. And to what extent can you work out the gaming and the unintended consequences in advance? Or to what extent do you have to adjust as you see those unintended consequences happening? And if you adjust, can you still see the longitudinal approach if you're changing to amend to avoid the unintended consequences?
Now, it seems to me that is an extremely good topic for a PhD thesis. You've got 2 minutes.
Well, look, it's a difficult thing. So this is how I think about it. First of all, you can't... In the end, you don't have to use the word target, but you can't not set targets. If you're a government that believes you want to change things in the world, you've got to describe what you mean. So you've got to say, the system is like this, and I'd like it to be like that. And then you've got to be able to see somehow whether you're making progress towards it. So whether you call it a target or not, in effect, you've got to set one. You've got to set some goals. Unless you're like the Prime Minister at the beginning of the 20th century, Lord Salisbury, who says... all changes for the worse, so it's in our interest that as little should happen as possible. And if you've just celebrated Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, you can see why you might have a Prime Minister like that, but the world has moved on since then. So you've got to have goals, that's point one. So then all the questions you raise arise. What we tried to do in the original delivery unit was, you'd say, well, we're going to cut this crime, and then what might be all the things that would go wrong? So you kind of brainstorm those, and then you say, well, how would we know if they're going on? And you say, we'll check. And then very often it turns out that most of those things don't happen. It's quite surprising how often that turns out to be the case. And then if one or more of them does happen, you then know, at least you can make an informed choice about whether that's the trade-off you want to make. Sometimes, of course, if you set a target, you're going to... You might get it wrong. I mean, nobody's going to be perfect about getting targets, although there's lots of ways that we got better at it in government, and in general, governments have got better at it. But you do have to then measure progress, and you can adjust on the way, and you need to keep the same data sets. What we always tried to do is make sure whatever data set your target was measured in, you had another completely separate data set that would give you some indication of whether what you were seeing in the target was actually real and not just... gamed, and then obviously you can audit data systems. So, for example, in crime, you would see recorded crime falling in a given area, and then the British Crime Survey, totally separate, 30,000 sample, that the same crime would fall a little bit later in that. Once you knew those patterns, you could be confident that something real was happening. If you relied on one data set, you're always going to struggle, and you certainly wouldn't be able to win the argument in public relying on one data set.
I kind of want to ask two questions. One is, tell us what you know about the pupils. That's a really important question, that they understand the data and they're tracking the data. And then the other is, what are the things you're trying to do that are nothing to do with data?
Yeah.
And you want good answers to both those questions.
Yeah. I didn't answer Steve's first question, which is, what kind of targets do you want to set? And that will vary, what kind of outcomes you want to manage to. But as I was saying to Matthew earlier, I think that the learning outcomes that we want to see are going far beyond the academic in the current, the way the education debate is developing, the way the global economy is developing. People are asking for things well beyond academic outcomes, and we will have to learn.
But the broader those goals get, and we're doing some work on this at the RSA, the harder it becomes, and the more the danger is that you become reductive. You say, well, we want children who are resilient and creative and confident. And then you can get into, okay, we're going to find a way of measuring that. And you'll end up, you're not going to measure those things. You're going to measure some pretty weak proxy for those things if you're not careful.
Yeah. And there's a kind of common sense rule with all of this. But I totally agree that you don't want to get reductive. And I know it hasn't, over the last 20 years, been the world's most popular organisation. But Ofsted Inspection at its best does get into some of that. It does look for the way the school works as a community, or it could.
Yeah.
That your explanation of drivers for change around legislation, regulation, and increased spending were really interesting, but the fourth elusive citizen motivation was perhaps the most interesting. I was wondering if, given your perhaps pessimistic take on what people think of government, if you've seen any really interesting ways to increase citizen motivation, and whether or not you see that something increasing in future.
We'll just have to take one question at a time, because they're all such good questions.
Do you want to answer that one? Because you write about that, but...
Well, can I answer it? And then Michael can. But I'll give you my favourite example, which is the mayor of Oklahoma is always my favourite example. The fat-busting mayor of Oklahoma, who one New Year's Day said to his staff that they were going to do a press conference outside the elephant cage in Oklahoma Zoo, and they didn't really know what he was going to do. So he turned up and he said to the people of Oklahoma, he said, "I'm fat, and I've been trying to lose weight for months, and I've failed, and I've decided I can only do it if you help me. So I want everyone in Oklahoma to help me lose weight, because we're a fat town, basically. So will you do it?" And they did it. And, you know, I think he set the goal of losing £1 million in weight, and they lost £1 million in weight, you know. And it was a great story. And Oklahoma, I think this is another thing about targets, by the way, that it lost weight. It's still quite a chubby place. But actually, Oklahoma as a place got a sense of agency and confidence about itself and connection to its mayor, which then was reflected in all sorts of other indicators in Oklahoma as a successful city. And so I think that that's an interesting example. But the other thing that's about that is that other mayors in America then tried to copy him and fell completely flat on their face, you know. So I think the thing about citizen motivation is it's very context specific. You know, somebody, you can do it once in one particular place with one particular leader at one particular moment. You try and copy it, and that's very different from deliverology.
Yes, it's true. But I think that is a great example. I think one of the things that people feel with big systems is that they're impervious and difficult to change. And so one of the things you need to do is demonstrate success, get some early wins, quick wins, whatever you want to call them. So at the beginning of the reform in Punjab, in Pakistan, that I'm going to, pretty much the whole system didn't think we'd make any progress. Not because they're bad people, because they just had a series of setbacks. So in their own heads, they've already given up. They kind of defeat themselves in their own heads. When they started making progress, they really got quite excited about it. And there's nothing like a bit of success to get people fired up and motivated. And so, you know, that's why in Matthew's example, they achieve losing weight, and then other things can shift as well, because you have to convince people, to put it better, people have to convince themselves that they can do this. So that works inside the system, but it also works with people outside and around the system, and you see things change, and it's sometimes through deliverology, but it's often through kind of social change or cycling habits in London. You know, I used to be a mad cyclist in the early 80s in London, and you'd hardly be at the traffic lights anywhere, and now there's a massive cyclist there. It's changed. There are lots of things that do change, but in the first thing you have to, I'm sort of adding to Matthew's example, you have to convince people that these big impervious systems can in fact change.
I think I'm going to respond to that by organising a standing ovation the next time West Brom win a throw-in, yeah. A football match. If we can achieve the throw-in, who knows what's possible after that? Okay, sorry. Let me take 1, 2, 3 hands, and then we'll take those as the last questions.
Hello, I'm Emma Knights from National Governors Association. And Matthew, you sort of asked my question 2 times ago, but I'm still going to ask it because I want help from Michael. We've recently published with Wellcome Trust a framework for governance for schools in which we are encouraging schools to really be visionary, to try and be creative about what it is that they want to measure. Before we got involved, Wellcome Trust ran a pilot of 21 schools to really try and get build on, as you say, the self-improving system. Come on, schools, you can do this. What is it that you really care about? And what is it you want to measure? And guess what? The pilot failed really quite dismally. They couldn't work out what they could measure in order to monitor what they cared about. So I think it is not difficult for us to provide a short, sharp framework saying, this is, guys, what you ought to be doing. It's much, much harder, as Matthew was saying, to really measure what is important. to us. So, I'd be really to get your comments about trying to do that in a self-improving system, that I wouldn't want us to try and start central government to be setting targets again. I think that would be destructive given where we are. But on the other hand, to do it ourselves is really hard. So how do we manage that conundrum?
Great question. And then there was a second hand. Yep.
I'm Patricia Lee here, an independent consultant, but I've worked in government for many years. And what you call efficacy seems to me to have a lot in common with something I would call benefits realisation. And, of course, in the public sector, there is meant to be quite a lot of benefits realisation. But I think it's done very badly, if at all. And I wonder whether you think that government can learn perhaps from what you've been doing, but also whether they can breathe some life into this to actually get it to work in the way that it should do, including taking into account disbenefits, for example, and involving everybody in setting what they think the benefits should be and involving the stakeholders who are needed.
And then finally in the front row over here.
Rashmi Bala, I've worked on change at local and global levels and in a variety of sectors. I concur that the policy rigidity that you've both articulated very well is a massive problem, and I'm curious, especially with an election coming up, what people outside of government can do to encourage government to be more of a learning environment, learning culture, and not just to do that within government and with respect to policy, but to balance targets and aspirational goals with allowing the organisations, let's say, in this case, the NHS, the social sector, the voluntary sector, to also have a learning culture and ethos that allows them to move progressively towards the larger outcomes that everyone wants.
Great. Because we actually don't do that, really, because what we actually do is insist that politicians make more and more concrete promises to us. So we actually encourage them to go in completely the reverse route, which is to over-specify outcomes all the time. But anyway, Michael, three difficult questions to finish off.
Yeah, well, I was hoping you might answer some of them. But start with the I think sometimes governments will want to set targets, so whether we like it or not. But that's an aside from your main point. I think the other thing I want to say, which relates to a previous question as well, is that we've got to beware of the false dichotomy. So, Matthew was saying earlier, there are these deeper, wider outcomes that you might want. But very often the schools that are good at the academic stuff will also be good at that. In general, the two will go together because they're good, effective organisations where people get on well, where they're inspired, where they're motivated, where they're doing well. And so the schools that do well on exam results will very often do well on all the other things. But what came into my head when you were talking was... another former colleague from the Blair days, Peter Hyman, has set up a free school called School 21 in Newham, and I was going to encourage you all to go and visit, but you probably wouldn't like it if you all go. But what they've set as their main mission is that the students should create beautiful work. That is their goal. Now that effect, and they've got a whole theme about language. So all the children, they're like 11, 12, just coming 13. Have to be able to present for 10 minutes like a TED talk. All of them have to be able to do it. They've got a thing about language. But his point is school isn't just about preparation for life and work. It's something to enjoy and savour daily by producing beautiful work. Now, I'm prepared to bet that they will get fantastic exam results as well. So I think that that's one of the ways for the kind of schools you're talking about to think about. What do we actually want to do? What do the parents want to do? What will ensure the children and young people thrive? How can we explain it? I'm not saying the exam results will take care of themselves, but up to a point, that's true. So I think that is actually a profound... Because if you're really seeking to produce beautiful work, you're going to learn all the stuff you need for your exams anyway, and they've really got that to a theme. I think the question about the
lessons from Pearson for if you were going back into the delivery into unit government. Now from using the stuff from Pearson.
I think it's really important to whether you use benefits realisation or efficacy or whatever the phrase. These are all bits of jargon that people develop. to be really clear with what you're doing, whether it's you yourself in work or an organisation or a whole government, to be really clear about how you want, by doing what you're doing, how you want people to benefit. That I talk a lot in my new book about stewardship, that the role of government or somebody leading a government, an agency or a school for that matter, is to leave the organisation better than you found it. And that's partly about delivering targets, but also about building the capacity of the organisation to keep delivering long after you've gone. It's also about using the money well. It's also about building great relationships with the citizens who depend on that institution. And I've set out a framework for kind of thinking about stewardship, which has those three elements. So that's what I would advise. And in Pearson, our equivalent of that is efficacy plus financial profitability and the great relationships with our customers. So we're thinking like that, and that's what I would recommend to anybody in government to think about. Stewardship, I think, is a key word here. And on...
how can we encourage politicians to... Yeah. To trust us, that they have to learn. They don't have to... I mean, Ed Miliband in his speech last year told us exactly how many houses he was going to build, exactly how many nurses he was going to employ. I mean, it's bonkers, to be honest. I mean, it's not a criticism of Ed particularly, but why do we want politicians to tell us exactly how many nurses they're going to employ in 10 years' time? I mean, it's mad, isn't it? But we're demanding it. If he didn't say how many nurses, we'd go, oh, how many nurses?
Yeah, you know, so. I don't have an answer to this because I agree we're in that kind of dialogue, but one of the things I was interested in, almost exactly a year ago, I went on the bullet train from Tokyo to Kyoto. Have you ever been on the bullet train?
No.
It is absolutely beautiful. So it comes in, I was getting the 9:10, it's called Shinkansen from Tokyo to Kyoto. It comes in, all the seats are facing forward, everybody gets off, comes in well before the time it's got to depart, obviously, unlike in England. And then by each door, after everybody's got off, four women in pink overalls get into through each door, and they make the train absolutely spotless, and then they turn all the seats around, so they're now facing forward for the journey back to Kyoto. And then about 9:05, the driver walks past in a resplendent uniform. This guy is so proud to drive this train, and it looks like a rocket, and it's absolutely beautiful, and it's spotless. And he walks past, and you know he's going to be in his cab on time, and then you all get on, and everything works, everything's spotless, and at 9:10, the train leaves. It doesn't go that fast to Yokohama, because it's not very far, but after Yokohama, it goes really fast. Mount Fuji's on the right, the coast is on the left. And then, you know, I now live in Devon, and I come to First Great Western, as I did this morning, from Tiverton to Parkway.
I sense there can be a contrast here.
Yeah, and, you know, and White Horse Hill isn't the same as Mount Fuji. There's nothing they can do about that. I accept. But the rest of it is about standards. It's about what you accept. And I think one of the things...
Bullet crew all have to commit suicide if the train's late or something, though? Don't they have a kind of... Isn't there a kind of quite a high level of expectation?
There is that everybody expects this whole thing to be absolutely fantastic. Its average lateness over a 30-year period is less than 1 minute. Whereas in Britain, even when we were using targets to drive up train performance, being within 10 minutes of the scheduled time counted as on time for an intercity train, which is ludicrous. The Japanese would never accept it. And the cleanliness and the windows are a bit grimy, and sometimes the tap in the toilet doesn't really work. And then you get towards Reading and they say there's congestion at Reading, and I think, don't they know we're coming? There's a timetable. So all of that, and that is about standards. And what I realised from this experience is the standards aren't actually just set by the people who run the trains, they're set by the passengers, the customers, and we can set standards, and we should set standards, and that's the way to get into this. So we should demand very high standards from our healthcare and our services, and when it falls short, we should challenge it. Because in the end, the standards are set by the people who accept them as well as by the people who provide them. So to me, that's the way into this. It's through standards, through the standards of the expectations, if you want a different word.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Michael. Michael isn't actually here to flog his book, but it would be wrong of me not to tell you that it is out and you can buy it on all good internet providing websites and bookshops and everywhere else. And it's a great read. But Michael was here mainly to talk about the Pearson work. We'll be publishing the RSA and Pearson, a summary of the seminars that we've had on efficacy. And I would say, in pay a compliment to Michael and to Pearson, that that will be a report which will talk about the challenges of the framework as well as the strengths of it. So it's been great working with Pearson. It's been great listening to your questions tonight, but can I ask you to join me in thanking Sir Michael Barber.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.